Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, if you're one of the 90 or so million people around the world with a Netflix account, then you'll be more than familiar with some of the online streaming services' original shows, whether it's The Crown, Stranger Things, House of Cards, or Orange is the New Black. These are the hits that get tongues wagging by the water cooler every day. Netflix has revolutionised the way we watch TV, and while most people seem to have an account, we don't know all that much about the company itself. So on today's show, we're going to LA to meet some of the people responsible for this cultural shift in addictive, binge-worthy series.
It's amazing to be on the cusp of a revolution of how video content is shown around the world and what that opens up for creators of that content.
It's Netflix and chill then for the next half an hour on Culture with me, Robert Bound. A couple of weeks ago, I went to Hollywood, home to what's going to be Netflix's brand spanking new offices and studio spaces too. Off Sunset Boulevard sits the Sunset Bronson Studio Complex. On the days I went, the place was being set up for a royal-themed Crown-tastic general meeting and party. Too bad my plane was set to leave that same night. I was there to meet three of the headiest honchos at Netflix. Three people who might well have had a very personal hand in changing the way you watch TV. And how it's written and produced, too. Netflix famously doesn't release their audience figures. We know that a lot of people have signed up to the service, but we don't know how many people are actually watching the shows, although you'd make an educated guess of some 200 million viewers across the world for their big-name shows. In we go then to get a little bit closer to that data. Todd Yellin oversees product experience at Netflix. This means he crunches the numbers received through what people watch and can advise on what's hot and what's not and how they lead viewers to new pastures. He explains how the company's changed over the past decade or so.
Netflix is 1/25th the size it is now when I got to Netflix around 11 years ago. So the team barely could do anything because we hardly had any people doing it. We all picked up a shovel and just dug whatever hole needed to be dug. Now, you know, we are a two-headed company, which is very rare, even perhaps unique. Many companies in our space are either a technology company that happens to do content and entertainment, or an entertainment content company that happens to do technology. And we are a true, you know, intertwining of what Hollywood represents and what Silicon Valley represents.
When I think of Netflix, I think of these wonderful shows. That's how most people think of it. They think of the programs you make, which I suppose is a part of its success. And we all know the raw materials of that are scripts and actors and actresses and soundtracks and all the rest of it. But your raw materials are very different. To give our listeners an idea in basic terms, like what are your raw materials in your job?
So it is very different because what we do on the product side of Netflix is we try to have this beautiful invisibility. We want the consumers, we want our members just to step in and watch another great episode of Stranger Things or The Crown, and that is nirvana for us. But the way we create that invisibility is we're taking things that are incredibly complex and making it brain dead simple for our members. Because it can be what goes underneath an internet TV service to get a beautiful picture and beautiful sound when you're watching on your phone or on your tablet or on your TV or on your TV, that smart TV versus connected to a game console. These are a lot of challenges. And we don't want the person who comes home from work and is exhausted and they have no brain cells left for anything but turning on the TV and watching something and sinking into their upholstery of their couch.
The idea of serendipity is something that very much existed in what we might call old media. The idea of buying a newspaper, and if you wanted to read the sports scores, you'd turn over two pages by accident and you'd be in the business section or the obituary section of a newspaper. And you would go, wow, this is fascinating. I would not normally look at this, but I have accidentally found it. There's an idea now, obviously, of trying to engineer accident into programming and all the rest of it. And I wonder what your view of that is the idea of engineering something that seems very human or something that has failure in it almost in order for it to appear human. Is that something that you're familiar with, or am I speaking rubbish? I don't know.
It's funny, when you describe this, you almost sound like an episode of Black Mirror written by the brilliant Charlie Brooker, where you're talking about...
I'm trying to take that as a compliment.
The engineering of serendipity. I love that, and maybe we'll show Charlie that as a potential episode idea. What we're trying to do, and you talked about, you know, you were asking me, what's changed over the years? Let me address your question in this way, which is, years ago, we were very naive on how we did our personalization and our algorithms. Someone would watch a romantic comedy, and then they would come back to the service, and then plastered from top to bottom on their homepage of their TV experience or their website experience, they'd see all romantic comedies. And that's a little bit of that echo chamber that, you know, we read a lot about in the news and in a lot of personalization and internet. We have transcended past that. That's when we were learning to crawl and then learning to walk. Now that we're in our pimply adolescence of personalization, what we've learned is, yes, pay attention to what our members are viewing, but then show a diversity of content. Show not only romantic comedy, but what's a first cousin of romantic comedy? Maybe romantic drama. What's a second cousin? Maybe wacky comedy. And so you show a third cousin, maybe a documentary about romance and the nature of love. So there's all kinds of, and then you go beyond that and go, this person, this member, has never watched a horror film. Let's throw the dice. Yeah. Let's see if they're interested in this. So we do program in diversity, and there is a human touch to the Netflix interface and the algorithms.
I mean, that's an interesting thing. Do you think that... And I want to talk to you about your relationship with commissioning, obviously, as well. And, you know, the idea of personalization is fascinating. When someone watches a romantic comedy and you give them a thought away from that and a thought away from that again and a thought away from that, you can almost become a commissioner, or you can almost become a program maker. You can invent new genres of things by kind of going, now, has anyone ever made a really interesting documentary about how these things work in the first place, or about how realistic a screenwriter's love life has to be in order for it to get on screen or whatever. This must be something that I don't know if the program makers consult you, or how officially or unofficially they consult you if they do, but there's a gap in the market here for this sort of intelligence, presumably.
Well, that's very reminiscent of another part of my team. So there's the algorithm side, and then there's the total movie and TV show geek side of my team. These are some of the world's experts in analyzing story and tearing apart movies and TV shows. They're the taggers. They're the ones who watch every single piece of content that Netflix licenses and produces, and they break it down into, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tags. They'll watch a movie or TV show, and they'll tell us, you know, things like, how cerebral is it? How happy or sad is the ending? How demanding is it, cognitive load? Is it totally escapist, like leave your brain at the door? How much violence? How much sex? What kind of sex? Is there smoking or no smoking? Is there a monkey? Is there a corrupt cop? Is there a corrupt cop with a monkey? And every little aspect of the story we're getting and we're cataloging. And so what we do with a lot of these tags and a lot of these different kinds of stories we have is we share it with our content partners. So we share it with the folks like Cindy Holland and Lisa Nishimura and Ted Sarandos and others on the team. And what they do is they're trying to create a diverse catalog. And so what they're looking at is they look at all these various tags and they go, we have an audience for, you know, dystopic science fiction stories. We haven't had one of those that will really play on Netflix. And then you get a show like, you know, a 3%, which came out of Brazil, that plays well into that genre or subgenre, or in our case, subgenre of the kinds of specificity and story. So a lot of what my team does feed into what the content team does when they're commissioning and producing different stories, from whether it be Hollywood or film production companies around the world.
And you were a documentary maker. You were on the other side of the camera, and you've been in dangerous and interesting places and made dangerous and interesting films about them. Do you feel that, I mean, you know, you're not some tech guy, in inverted commas, are you at all? Does Netflix nourish both sort of sides of that, this new job, 10 years old job that you've got, and the filmmaker side of you?
It's amazing to be on the cusp of a revolution of how video content is shown around the world and what that opens up for creators of that content. It was great back in the days when I was smuggling footage out of Myanmar, or taking my camera across the Himalayas to shoot refugees. That was exciting. That was fun. That was before I had a wife and kids. That was great to do back in that day. And that was a very different chapter in my life. There is a very high creative side to what we can do, design, and with our algorithms on Netflix that is very satisfying and very exciting.
You have no idea what it means to have nothing. You don't value what we have achieved. I have had to fight for everything my entire life.
Todd Yellin there. Now we know some of the analytical secrets, what about getting a show commissioned? Cindy Holland is Vice President of Original Content, working on series, docs and stand-up comedy. Not a bad gig, huh? She's been at the company for 15 years and is responsible for many of the programmes that we've grown to love since Netflix's original content took off. Here she explains what that role entails.
All of the things that we're doing are loved by someone, obviously. They have to be loved by many members, depending on, you know, how much they cost to produce. And our ambition is to have every single person's favorite show. It's not always the same show, but you know, we'd like to have something for everyone, truly. You know, certainly in terms of the success of the initiative, House of Cards was incredibly important and set us down a path to success. Arrested Development, you know, reviving and continuing that show for the many fans around the world was pretty special for us. And, you know, from the early set of shows that we did, certainly Orange is the New Black was kind of the thing that came out of nowhere for a lot of people. Certainly not for us. I mean, we believed in Jenji Cohen's vision. We believed in the creative. And as that show was in production and we were seeing, you know, this wonderful world of women come to life, you could really see it was something special.
And your remit under original content is vast, potentially. Well, not potentially, it is. So is that kind of part of the joy of the job, that you actually don't know what's going to be coming across your desk each day, who you're going to be meeting with, what conversations you're going to be having? Because even within the specialized world of TV and film production, things get pretty specific pretty quickly. But it seems like your job is exceptionally varied. I mean, you know, you're not doing it all on your own, but the buck stops with you. So tell us about, is there such a thing as a typical day?
There really isn't a typical day, to be honest. It, you know, it could be in Los Angeles in the office and having meetings with producers on potential new or existing projects. You know, most of my reading time is sort of off hours at home and weekends, and the same with viewing of episodes. You know, other days I may be in New York, where we have quite a number of productions, and, you know, sort of going from production, one production to another, and, you know, checking in on people, and more ambassadorship than a lot of giving of directives. But basically trying to be a good ambassador to the community, helping the team we have in place solve problems. You know, at a certain point, it's much more of a managerial role and a problem solver role than it is an active creative one. But I do try to take the time to get as involved in the projects that are going well as the ones that, you know, may need my help more.
There's quite a lot of sort of shopkeeping in a way involved in it. Has that allowed you to kind of splash out on, I mean, The Crown, I know, is obviously sort of famously expensive show to make. Are there projects that you've had that, you know, you've been a bit hamstrung because you're like, damn, you know, this is amazing. We need this UFO scene in it, but it's not going to happen because actually it's kind of a niche show. Does that affect the creatives? Does that affect what happens on screen? To your trained eye, it probably does, but I wonder how compromise is reached in those situations.
Well, I don't think there's much that would be visible to our viewers. I mean, we're really focused on executing the best creative version of a given series that we decide to commission. So, you know, we're not afraid of investing what it takes to make something great. You know, referring back to Stranger Things, you know, there's a version of that series that could be really, really expensive, as you can imagine, with special effects and all kinds of things. But, you know, the Duffer's vision was, well, this was set in 1983, and it should be relatively practical effects, and it should feel of that time. And, you know, so there's a desire to keep it as low-tech as possible while still delivering, you know, something great for the fans around the world. And I think we've accomplished that. Certainly more to come. You know, we're busy at work on season two now.
Thank God for that. I wanted to ask you about that show specifically, because that seems to be so many people, I'm 39, so many people of my age loved that. So many people in my office loved that show, lapped it up. You know, it was a competition to see who could finish it first, who could like it more. So there's an interesting demographic thing there as well, because people of our age have got a few quid, you know. And so how does that work? Do you, I presume that is part of the commissioning process and the data service as well, the data part of it is looking at, you know, what demographic something is aimed at and whether or not you can spend a few more dollars on it, right?
You know, the interesting thing is we actually don't think about demographics specifically when we're commissioning something. We do want to know how big we think the audience will be, or what's the minimum threshold size audience we need to be able to afford the thing we'd like to make. And then we think about, well, being really specific, what specifically are we making? What is the very specific creative intent of the project? And then we have a conversation about who's it for? Who are we making this for? And, you know, I had, you know, as an example, and had conversations with Baz Luhrmann about The Get Down. And, you know, he said, I always like to imagine who is in the seat in the theater or who's on the other side, who's on the couch watching that screen when I create something, he said. And, you know, so we would have conversations about who are the people who are going to show up? What kinds of folks are they? And, you know, that's something that we think about with our series. And we certainly expected that, you know, there is some nostalgia audience for Stranger Things. Yeah. But originally it came into the company as a part of our young adult initiative. And we thought, well, you know, that's interesting. We think teenagers will watch it, but we also think we have a wider opportunity. You know, folks like you and myself, you know, older and even people our age and maybe even older who have kids.
I met Todd Yellen yesterday and we had a really interesting chat about the numbers side of it, the data side of it. Do his facts and figures help you to commission or not? Or do they steer the sorts of things that get made in terms of werewolves aren't very sexy for the last 5 years, but, you know, something else, but zombies are, for example, you know, I mean, is obviously his data and his analytics help you make decisions. And I think that's fair to say, but I wonder how explicitly they do.
We certainly spot trends in the data that help us understand what are areas of white space.
You mean opportunities by white space? Yeah.
Sorry, white space equals opportunities in business speak. So that's one part of my brain working. One thing we were noticing is that, you know, when we would survey families, we would see, you know, there's a spike on sort of movies from the 80s that you would see on a Saturday night. And we're like, well, what's that about? So we did some consumer insights and we're talking to members of like, well, why do you do that? Well, I'm looking for something I can watch with my family. And I remember this being a safe movie, yeah. Goonies, for example, you know, when I was younger. And then sometimes it's true that it is. And sometimes, you know, their memory is different from the reality.
It's quite scary, actually.
Right. You know, and that was one signal that led us to think about, well, you know, who is programming for families specifically on television, for whole families on television? And the answer is almost nobody. You know, there's a little bit of the big broadcast networks in the U.S., but, you know, much of the landscape has been divided up into cable channels or satellite channels that have narrowly defined programming mandates and demographic targets that they're trying to reach. And so that kind of splits apart the family in a way and has everybody watching a different channel.
Yeah.
And so we thought, well, you know, what are the kinds of programming that we could commission where you might actually get the whole family to watch together? That led to Fuller House. That certainly became an intent behind Stranger Things. And not necessarily like everybody is actually watching at the same time. But, you know, we aspired to have household word of mouth. So you would have either a child or a parent would watch it and then tell the family members about it, and then they would, you know, hopefully individually catch up on it on their own or watch it again together. And anecdotally, we've definitely seen that has happened.
Cindy Holland, congratulations on having the most enviable job in the world. Thank you very much indeed. Soy el fuego que
arde tu piel. Finally, we're going to focus on documentaries now, for which Netflix-produced films have been nominated for an Oscar again this year for 13th, the fifth time in 4 years, in fact. Lisa Nishimura is head of documentaries at Netflix, and when I met her, she was just fresh back from Sundance, where she'd premiered four new projects. We discussed the nature of documentary film and why it's a priority at Netflix.
The best documentaries tend to be those things that really look at the human condition, in my opinion. And so I think, generally speaking, if the storytelling is well done in some fashion, you relate, right? You see yourself in some way in the subjects or the characters that are addressed. So I do think that there tends to be more compassion, perhaps in the way that they're viewed. But we're really hoping to be coming to the table and say, let us actually elevate the production values. Let's work with the world's best documentarians. Let's give them the resources that they need to not just be able to discover and find the best stories out there, but to actually bring them to life in the most profound, innovative, connective way. And that's what we're really working on.
How does that work when you first meet someone that wants to, has pitched you an amazing documentary film? What's your first kind of line of inquiry?
I always start from the place of questioning and inquiring. I'm deeply, deeply curious about what is the project that that particular director has a hard time sleeping every night because they're thinking about it.
Yeah.
That's what I want to know. Because the documentary is going to require that much rigor and passion and commitment. So it's the question of what is that thing that you're aching to tell? And then walk me through how you want to tell it. Because that's something that we really, really love, is sort of how do you innovate the form, whether it's structure, whether it's style, and really, really just listening, spending a lot of time just asking what is it that you really want to create. Because I do think documentarians in particular are exceptionally curious, they're exceptionally disciplined, and they're incredibly, their perseverance is unlike anything, right? And it's not unusual for projects to take years and years and years. I mean, you know, the directors of Making a Murder, Laura Ricciardi and Moira Demos, they worked on that project for 10 years. Right. And it's quite something. And that's not that unusual with documentarians to really, really stick with a subject matter to get to the core of a story in the most intimate and accurate way.
And it's strange. I mean, the many and varied things that have come across your desk in your time doing this must be kind of mind boggling. I'd love to know what world you came from originally. You've been at Netflix for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about you at Sundance with your Parker on and people pitching you documentaries once they know who you are. How do you kind of keep the quality control when you kind of have, oh, this is my favorite pet subject? Do you have to always have your, you know, I suppose your Netflix hat is an attractive one, but does it allow you or disallow you to do certain things?
I don't mean to sound silly when I say this, but I mean this genuinely. I feel like I have the best job in the world, you know, and particularly because what we're dealing with is real life. You know, it's a real honor to hear people's stories. Doesn't mean that every single one of them is right for us, or that a particular way in which it's being told is right for us. But we do everything we can to listen to all those stories and to really understand what makes the heart of that story tick.
We talked with Todd yesterday about the data and the analytics and all the rest of it. How closely do you and he work? Cindy said she works very closely with him, and it does affect the outcome of certain things. Not hugely explicitly, but of course it does, because if you've got that information, you're not going to flush it down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
On your side of things, I'm thinking it probably works differently, but does it? I mean, I think maybe you have more of a pioneering idea about a pioneering spirit of the documentary side of things.
I appreciate your impression of me.
What, the fist? That's holding the standard, running into battle. There she goes.
What gave it away? So, yeah, I mean, the beauty, again, the cross-section of art and science at Netflix is brilliant, right? The idea that you could have incredibly powerful, accurate, real-time information, of course we're going to use it. But I use it to really inform and to really sort of expand the view of what is possible. Again, it's that cross-section of understanding the potential of a project across an audience that I think is quite powerful. And I work extremely closely with Todd and his team, which represents what we call product, or the sort of any way in which you engage with a Netflix service, whatever your device might be, whether it's a huge flat screen in the living room, or if it's your iPad or your laptop or your phone or otherwise. And so for us, it's extremely important to be partnering with Todd and his team around how certain shows are presented onto the service. And one of my absolute favorite things, the thing that I think is a complete game changer on top of being global, is that the way that we present content is not siloed by genre.
right? So on a lot of different services, if you go to, you hit a tab at the bottom that says sports or comedy or documentary, and you're in a silo. And that's exciting if you're a fan of that category. But with Netflix, every single title is really reviewed and tagged based on not just the standard things of who's the director, who's the actor, what's the subject, what's the genre, it's tonalities, right? So it's the feeling that you derive from that experience of engaging with that story, which means that a documentary that is, as you were saying, about pioneering spirit, maybe it's a David and Goliath story, maybe it's about overcoming adversity and really triumphing at the end, that documentary has a very good chance of being recommended to somebody off of a scripted narrative feature or one of our scripted series because the tonalities match, right? Because you generally don't view and say, I want to watch this genre. You say, I feel like,
yeah.
I want to feel like XYZ, right? And again, going back to the very best documentarians, they move you to feel certain ways, right? And the idea that our service allows the engagement across different types of content, again, whether that's a genre or a short to a series, to a movie, that flexibility, it's not driven by anything other than the quality and the tonality of the storytelling. That means folks that might say, well, I don't consider myself a documentary viewer, might find themselves watching and loving a documentary. And there have been a few times, actually, we do a lot of what we call consumer insights. We like to spend a lot of time with our members and really understand firsthand from them how do they engage with the network.
Is that physical meeting?
It is. It takes a lot of different forms. But yes, these are physical meetings, and I love attending them whenever I can because I'm so curious about, you know, how our members engage with the service. And this is done on a global basis, so we're looking at audiences in all different markets all around the world. And I remember sitting in one of these sessions, and I looked at this group, and I wrongly assumed, embarrassingly so, upon looking at somebody, that I sort of pegged what kind of viewer they must be, just visually, you know. And before I knew it, he started talking about something, and he said, I got to tell you something about Netflix. I was halfway through a movie before I realized it was real people and real lives. I'd never watched a documentary before. I was floored, and now it's my favorite thing that I watch. I just didn't even know that there was there was that category of content. And I remember feeling just really delighted and also a little ashamed that I made the presumption, right? But then it really reminded me of the promise of what the service provides, because we don't actually have demographic information. We don't know people's age. We don't know their socioeconomics. We don't know their race. We don't know their education. And I think in a way, that's brilliant.
So you just know what else they've watched.
Exactly. So we're really, really looking at every recommendation, not off any kind of bias other than the information that you have freely and actively given to us based on what you viewed. And so that means that you might have somebody who's in their 70s in Japan watching very similar types of content as a teenager in Norway, and those cohorts might inform each other about what the next best thing to watch is. Based on the demographics, you probably wouldn't have even thought to put them together, right? And so it cracks open a universe of real information. So when you say, how do you think about working with the data? That's what gets me excited, is we're actually looking at viewers as lovers of content, not as these standard demographics that I think a lot of other services and networks really do, because they're maybe perhaps advertising driven, right? So they need to create content or program content specifically to, you know, sell toilet paper, right? That's not what we're about. For us, it's really about serving the very best story at the exact moment on the right device for every single subscriber. So that's great.
That was Lisa Nishimura, head of documentaries at Netflix, and that brings us to the end of this Netflix special from Hollywood. What impressive stories these people are in charge of, and what wonders they've put in front of our eyes. A full story on the people that light the green lights at Netflix will appear in Monocle's anniversary issue 101, March, out in a couple of weeks. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly Fisher, the 11 to my mic. Join me again at the same time next week, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thanks for tuning in.